Lunch with Leon is brought to you by Total Care, the UK experts in lifting and testing equipment for commercial vehicle workshops. Visit totalcare.co.uk and learn about their market-leading mobile column lifts, fixed post lifts, brake testers, inspection pits, and more. Total Care, lifting business one vehicle at a time.
Senior industry commentator Chris Cheek has been monitoring facts about the bus and rail industry for many years. He studies the data and knows what it says about us. He tells it to Leon Daniels at Lunch with Leon in this latest episode.
So Chris, I was just thinking, you spent a whole chunk of your life, I think, doing a great service for the bus and coach industry, which is analysing its financial performance, putting it together in such a way as to perhaps rank people in some sort of order. And unless I'm much mistaken, your conclusions throughout this period is that, with a few notable exceptions, this industry doesn't make enough money to pay all of its costs and its investment and its obligations, does it?
No, it doesn't. And it hasn't done for a long time. And I think the consequence is that, you know, I've seen all my career what Burke Trend, when he was cabinet secretary, called the orderly management of decline. And I think it's very sad, but I think, you know, given the demographic and other social changes that we've seen over those, well, it's 49 years next week, actually, have been so massive that it was inevitable that things would keep changing. What upsets me often is that the management still gets the blame.
Sure. It is interesting. And I don't suppose you or I ever expected to live through a period where a Conservative government undid its deregulation agenda of the 1980s. And you and I find ourselves here today on the brink of a newly regulated bus industry, but where, from what I can see, there's quite a lot of rhetoric from government, but we haven't yet seen any money, have we? And, you know, the bus strategy itself never uses the word funding without the word discretionary in front of it. It must be pretty tricky to be a company right now, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I was writing something the other day and I used the phrase unprecedented uncertainty. And I think that's the real big issue. That nobody knows what's going to happen over the next couple of years. Meanwhile, as you say, the government has all these aspirations and makes all these wonderful statements, but I don't think they really have any idea what's involved. Certainly, there is no prospect, I think, of the sort of money we would need to see in order to achieve what they want in the strategy.
I'm concerned. I mean, as we know, even the department is on a one-year spending review. The work for the next year's spending review is underway right now. Nobody in the DFT will talk about anything other than the spending review. And it's far from clear to me that the Treasury is prepared to make the money available that the strategy document talks about, because it talks about, you know, significant increases in frequencies and significant reductions in cost. It's running in parallel with a campaign to go to net zero by 2040 or some other deadline locally. Well, that's a phenomenal amount of money to be spent over a very long period. And I can't see that passing the Treasury, no matter what the strategy document says.
No, I think there will be a hope that the industry could become self-sustaining again with enough modal shift. And, you know, the numbers are there in the sense that if you do the sums on what the Climate Change Committee wants to be achieved in terms of modal shift, then actually you're talking about a doubling or even more of bus patronage over the next 10 years. Quite where we're going to get all the drivers from, I don't know, but that's another matter. I think that's the hope, that that there is so much income from modal shift that it starts to pay for itself again. Whether that happens or not, I don't know.
No. Well, of course, I am reminded from my time in TfL that our rescue from deficit into sustainability was all predicated on the revenue from Crossrail. And we often used to put out a story that said, when Crossrail opens, it will be full. But that all assumes that there is infinite suppressed demand, growing population, growing economic activity, and the more you build capacity, the more people will travel. And eventually you get to the point where there's enough people traveling to make it financially sustainable. But if I just think back to the year or so before the pandemic, so sort of 2018, 2019, we know plenty of rail franchises, don't we, that were predicated on huge increases in patronage as a result of newer trains, faster trains, blah, blah, blah. We now know, don't we, that even before COVID, that growth was softening at best. The rate of growth was getting lower, but actually in many cases, the ridership was stagnating or even falling. And I just wonder whether, with the added complication of COVID, that whether there is just enough demand at any place to generate the revenue that's necessary to pay at the end of the day £350,000 for a zero emission double-decker bus and £40,000 a year to pay a driver. I just wonder if the demand is there at all.
Yeah, I agree with you because, you know, my analysis over the past 12 months, and I keep sort of looking at it and tweaking it and looking at some more figures and so on, but it still comes to the same conclusion that if you look at demand post-COVID and post all the changes that have gone on during COVID, we're never going to get back to the same levels. And I looked at it by journey purpose, which is a very interesting way of doing it. Work journeys are going to be down, I reckon, 10 or 11%, depending on how many people do hybrid working. Shopping trips, the latest footfall statistics are good year on year. But if you go back to pre-COVID, we're still talking 20-25% down. And that, in bus terms, that feeds straight through into the number of passengers we carry as an industry. And you know, they're not coming back. And we're never going to get back to those sorts of levels of demand. I will say that the bus industry is a bit better off than the rail industry. Because, of course, you know, buses only rely for about 20% of their demand on commuting, whereas where railways is over 47%. So, and of course, the big boom in rail travel that's kept everything ticking over financially for the last 20 years has been the business travel boom. And of course, that's gone away now as well. So the rail industry is in big trouble, but buses are certainly an uncertain future at best.
Does your research and your figures give us one piece of light, perhaps, which is that 10% you quoted, I've quoted 15% of traffic that will never return. If that's mostly in the peak, then we might end up with a flatter day. And since we have so much spare resource, everything from garage capacity to vehicles tied up, in the peak, we might get some cost efficiencies out of that because we might just have a flatter day. Does your figure support that?
I would be concerned about that. I mean, that may be true in London, Leon, but I don't think it's true outside London because for some years the peak hasn't been commuting, the peak has been schools. And I don't think that's going to go away. I mean, who knows what's going to happen to the education system? I'm sure the Secretary of State doesn't. But yes, so in that sense, I'm not sure that there are those savings to be had. And therefore, you know, we are in a position where we'll be looking. I mean, everybody's doing leisure marketing. Everybody's doing destination marketing. I know a bit about that. National Bus Company formed a company in London a few years ago, especially to do it. And, you know, that's all good stuff. But it's all going to be at the margin. We're not going to recapture shopping and commuting revenue from leisure traffic and tourism.
So all of that then means that the bus industry is basically committed to an everlasting subsidy support mechanism from government?
For the next 5 years, I would guess that would be the case. If we can get modal shift going, and if we can achieve growth in demand across the country resulting from that, then we could recover. But the real worry is what damage has been done in the meantime.
Sure. So the other one that used to interest me in London, and David Begg and I talked about this, and we'd done some work on it, which is very roughly the deficit on the bus operating arrangements in London, which is now 750 million, but at the time was more like 6 to 650, was roughly the cost of the congestion. That is to say, it was the cost of all the extra resource that was necessary to run buses very slowly in an unattractive way. And therefore, one way out of the sort of subsidy demand, if you like, the heroin that the industry is and may well become more hooked on, is if you could deal with the congestion, then you would make a substantial reduction in costs. Does that feel right outside London as well?
Yes, I think it is right. And I think in London, the interesting thing, of course, is we did an exercise some years ago looking at how much money you could save by relinking all the routes that had been split. And we got to 100 million on three corridors.
Well, I hope you've resubmitted that piece of work. I think 100 million would be welcome in the current financial climate over there.
But of course, you can't do it unless you can run the things reliably, which is why the routes were split in the first place. Get the priority, get the traffic congestion dealt with, and then you could certainly look to save the costs big time, I think.
Because we are actually worse off now, aren't we? Because the car-led recovery, I am seeing some numbers now that suggests that traffic is over 100% of the equivalent pre-COVID period, whereas public transport is floating in the 40s, 50s and 60s. Mm. So basically, I characterise it like this. There were some people who are steadfast car users. Chris, you know the sort of people. Look, I think there should be cheap and plentiful public transport, but I have to use my big estate car to go to work because actually once a year I have to go skiing. So the marginal cost of using my car is so small that I have to use it. But I think everybody else should be on public transport. So quite a lot of those people, and I put this down to the generational factor, we'd got over the hill. Thanks, I think, to the pressure from young people, the pressure from the whole green lobby. So even some of the most ardent supporters of the private car had been shamed to using more public transport. And then comes along COVID, wallop, and that rapidly declining asset that sits on their driveway 22 hours a day, which is really another room in their house. But that room in their house goes anywhere. So it's got your stuff in it. It's got your music in it. It's got everything. It's got all your conveniences in it. And for me, I've seen a whole lot of people back in their cars on this safety kick, not helped at all by a government that continues to say that the coronavirus travels by public transport, which I think has been hugely damaging and I think has had a lasting effect and is also not true.
All of the above. Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And certainly the numbers, you're right about the numbers. It is very disturbing to see that traffic levels went back to 100% more or less straight away in April and have stayed there and are starting to creep above 100%. And that's going to take a lot of time and a lot of effort to recover from, I think. And I'm not sure how we go about it because, you know, on the one hand, there is no evidence that public transport is a cause of communication of the virus. But then on the other hand, everybody says confined spaces and we are running at 30,000 plus new cases a day. People are nervous and particularly, you know, I get very nervous at my age and with my health issues when I see that you know, people, even though they've been vaccinated, are being admitted to hospital and dying of the thing. So I think there is the safety thing, and that's not going to go away for a while. And then there is the attitude thing, and it's going to take a lot of recovering from.
Chris, at the risk of making our listeners suicidal if they're in this industry, there's also this get out of jail free card, which of course is the battery electric car, which, of course, exempts you from any sort of congestion charge, exempts you from any sort of road tax, exempts you from any sort of fuel duty. And you feel rather smug, don't you, in your electric car in a long queue of traffic? Because I'm not, and you and I've talked about this many times, congestion and air quality used to be married. You got both.
Yes.
You had congestion, you caused pollution. While you were causing pollution, you were part of you were part of the congestion. And I don't think anybody really thought through, certainly government didn't think through, that with the advent of reasonably widely available zero emission cars in this case, that marriage is over. Now you can have zero pollution congestion. And a city full of zero emission vehicles going nowhere is still a city going nowhere. And I wonder two things. The car-led recovery is actually being stoked by the ability to buy zero emission vehicles, which stops you from feeling bad if you were feeling bad in the first place. And secondly, it's financially unsustainable because there's 38 billion worth of fuel duty and VAT, I think, for internal combustion engine vehicles, which has to be replaced because they that builds schools and hospitals. Aircraft carriers. I can't get any answer from government about how it's going to deal with that. And it's interesting, isn't it? The decarbonisation strategy, the bus strategy. Nothing we've seen from government has got the words road and pricing in the same sentence.
No, absolutely. And you know, at the risk of being a boring old man, you know, I've been saying for years they'll solve the air quality question before you can solve the congestion question. And then where we'll be left if the only argument we've got is the green argument, and that's now coming to pass, I'm afraid. And yes, but I think there is a lingering hope amongst politicians that this will solve the issue. You know, we are dealing with a generation of politicians, after all, who are still caught like rabbits in the headlights of the fuel tax rebellion. And, you know, all right, you and I might know that Gordon Brown reaped the whirlwind there because he pushed the envelope too hard. If it had been left at RPI plus one or even RPI plus 1.5, they might have got away with it. But he pushed it too hard. I think at maximum the escalator was RPI plus 3, which was too much. But now, of course, the consequence of that is that politicians won't put fuel duty up at all. So we're left with that. And as you say, we've got this looming problem of the 38 billion that they're not going to be collecting from fuel duty. Let's face it, in the current situation, they're going to need every penny they can get. So road pricing is the only answer. But I'm back to yes, Minister, you know, brave decisions cost you votes, Minister. Courageous decisions cost you elections. I think road pricing is a courageous decision.
How true. How absolutely true. Well, provided we've got some listeners left who haven't just gone off and got themselves very worried, there must be some signs of optimism for our industry, because we are seeing areas of growth, aren't we? We are seeing people doing good things in terms of quality, good things in terms of marketing and advertising. So let's try and think optimistically. There are some good things coming through, aren't there?
Mm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And some very, you know, I think there are also upsides from the COVID pandemic, in the sense that I think to an extent it has transformed the public's view of drivers and other frontline staff, which is a good thing. But yes, there is good quality. And when I look back to the industry I joined, or the industry I actually helped manage for 15 years before I concluded that it was easier to tell other people how to do it, was that, you know, when I look back, and I know I've heard you and Peter Hendy say this as well, we have made such strides in the quality of our vehicles, in the interiors, in the quality of our staff, in the way we approach and care for customers, that actually, you know, it's barely the same industry that I joined in 1972. You know, we actually washed them, and all sorts of things have changed in a way that we couldn't have envisaged at the time. And I know from all sorts of friends that the European industry envies us our ability to focus on customers and focus on the quality of the service we give. And to do all that in the face of the ongoing traffic congestion and all the rest of it is, I think, a major achievement.
I think it is. And you and I lived through broadly an industry that was run by engineers for the benefit of the staff, to one that's run by the marketing and innovative people on behalf of the passengers. And that's quite a transformation. In fact, on social media recently, there was an interesting question about on our annual pilgrimage to the lost village of Imba, which was a couple of Saturdays ago. And Imba Village, as you know, was seized by the government in 1943 from the villagers and never given back. And once a year, we run buses from neighbouring communities to Imba on one of the days when the army allows the place to be opened. And that raises a lot of money for a number of very worthy charities. But all the services carry the same number, which is 23A. And what we're doing there is just slightly poking fun at the fact that in order to overcome a trade union agreement in the 1950s and 60s, that drivers and crews could only work on one route per shift. Actually, all the journeys, no matter to which town or village, had the same number in order to meet the requirements of the trade union agreement, even though it was completely confusing to passengers and an impossible thing to sell. Mm. And Sir Peter Hendy and the team that run Imba very much enjoy this this little bit of looking back and reminding ourselves how the services were run for the benefit of the staff. They were run in order to stay sweet with the trade union, and the passengers were a very poor fourth after everybody else, including the engineers. So you're entirely right. We've now got to a place where the passenger is king. Mm. And the only drawback is where we started is there's just not enough of them and not enough of them at the right place at the right time. Mm. And I am fascinated. I'm fascinated on a number of these areas because on the face of it, it's a brilliant proposition. If you live in a place where there's a decent bus service, the need to own a car is almost zero. The need to use it certainly is almost zero. And this wonderful mode of transport just drops out of your mind at the end of the journey. Somebody else has to park it, fuel it, insure it, and so on. Now, some of the optimists would say that what will deliver us out of this is autonomous vehicles, because as soon as you take 50% of the cost away, which is the labour, then you've transformed the economics of it. I'm not sure you and I will live long enough to ever see that, but do you think it will happen in our industry?
I don't know. I mean, you know, one can see the attraction of it, obviously, and but, you know, I am minded of the fact that we used to do some benchmarking exercises a few years ago on light rail. And one of the things we found, much to our surprise, was that the DLR as an automatic driverless railway actually cost more to run than a traditional tramway. And, you know, that was because each vehicle was staffed, because you needed passenger reassurance and ticket checking and all the rest of it. And the risks. Now, autonomous vehicles do still have risks, as we saw in Japan the other day. I'm not sure how well the technology will actually... I don't think you'll ever get to a zero risk. And therefore, you will always risk the tabloid headline about the accident that killed somebody or injured a little boy or whatever. It will be a long time before the public would trust such a system, I think. And I don't think you could ever run it without any human involvement.
So on that basis, then, we're committed to a labour cost in public transport, no matter how clever the technology, because the passengers will demand some sort of reassurance, and probably the population as a whole will want some sort of reassurance that in the event of some sort of emergency, there's somebody to take over and take charge and so on. Oh, no, I get that. I certainly don't see we'll see it in our time. Although I do think people, when they're talking about autonomous vehicles, tend to think about the way in which our streets are presently organised, and a free-for-all on an existing road network, in fact, even a mixed free-for-all, would be really very complicated and crazy. But of course, nothing prevents major changes to road layouts and the sorts of vehicles that use them in order to have a higher level of autonomy. Which is why I think I'd always thought that the first place we'd like to see any sort of autonomy on vehicles is probably in the suburban and rural taxi market, where a small vehicle that'll demand responsive, take itself off and charge itself and put itself back on the grid again later, is a much more likely early development than where you really want it, which is an intensive urban operation with large vehicles. And I think that'll be I think that'll be hard. Chris, what other trends are you observing at the moment in all of your researches? Are there any other clues in the numbers and in the things that you see that gives us a clue to the future?
I think that the major difficulty is that everything is clouded by the uncertainty of COVID. So that, there were all sorts of interesting trends developing, particularly, we have partly led by COVID, but it was already unstoppable. We have achieved another revolution that we haven't talked about, which is the ticketing revolution. And, I've said for years that the great achievement of Oyster was to take the thought of the price out of people's minds. And, my joke is that if you actually knew how much you were paying for your underground journey, you'd probably walk. But, so that has been an enormously positive trend and, of course, was key to the industry, bus industry, being taken seriously in saying that it wanted to go faster. Because, of course, while ever 30 or 40% of the delays on any delay survey you did were about stopping and collecting fares, then, it hampered the industry. Now everybody is back to a small number of seconds per transaction, which is a great achievement over the last few years. And that's got buried.
Yes, it has. And as you rightly say, it does two things. One is it takes away the delay of fumbling for coins and change. And the second thing that it does is it just takes away you knowing what the price is. And I am fascinated how people, in touching a contactless card, effectively are giving over to the operator of the system a free-for-all to clear out your bank accounts. But actually, with a trust and a knowledge that you will be charged the optimum price for the sum total of all of the journeys that you make on that particular day or week or month or year. And that is a tremendous confidence that people must have in the system, because it's the equivalent of a blank check, but people are perfectly happy to rely on the system to do that, much more so than I ever expected. I expected more to be in the sort of electronic purse, which only had £10 in it, so you couldn't be fleeced for more than £10. But actually, people are using their mainstream debit cards on their account that's got a 10 grand overdraft limit on it, which in theory could be used. And I know there's plenty of protections in there, but I am fascinated that people are no longer interested in working out the optimum fare. They're happy to let the system do that calculation for them because their lives are too busy to even worry about it.
Yes, I think and that's coming outside London as well. First are rolling out the capping, tap and cap, all over the country as we speak, and the others are following. So, it is going to be a universal thing. And that will, in calmer times, that will have enormous advantages, I think, in terms of changing people's attitude towards price and towards the service that they're getting.
And it probably affects the elasticity on pricing decisions, doesn't it? Because, frankly, nobody will notice the annual RPI increase or the annual RPI plus one, because all these numbers are small numbers. I still ask myself the question, do I really pay £2.75 for a cup of hot water with a tea bag dropped into it at a mainline station, where I add my own sugar and my own milk and pull my own tea bag out and put it in a bin and put the lid on? But of course, as you said, the transaction is so painless. And I only know it's £2.75 because I looked at it the other day because I realized I didn't know what the price was because my contactless transaction saved me from knowing the price. And frankly, £2.75 is a lot of money for a cardboard cup of hot water and a tea bag. I'm as gullible a consumer as anybody else is on that. And if I want a cup of tea at a mainline railway station, they've made it terribly easy to separate me from £2.75.
Yes. And that's a lesson we've got to learn. I think the other thing going along with that is that I think the operators outside London, or the stats tell me that the operators outside London, have been pursuing volume at the expense of yield. And I think this is one of the problems that underlies the financial difficulties that the industry was heading for even before COVID, that actually, if you looked, they were getting castigated, as all public transport operators do, for real-term fares increases, but it wasn't translating into the yield. And in some cases, the yield was lower in real terms than it was 20 years ago. And that's worrying, and people have got to get a lot smarter about that, because that's key, because there is revenue in there that can be had relatively simply and relatively uncontroversially, I think.
And I mean, I've been watching, in fact, I saw Martin Gilbert yesterday, but I've been watching his initiative in Go Northeast, where as part of stimulating traffic, he did some aggressive price reductions for evenings and weekends, I think, where it seems to have done the trick. He seems to have stimulated sufficient demand to more than cover the loss of revenue that the price reduction gave. And that's got to be a blend of the right price and the right marketing activity. But it sounds simple enough, because if you're running a corner shop, that's also the same thing that you would do. But the industry still doesn't seem very good at those sorts of initiatives. And we only see pockets of them, don't we?
Yes, I think that's right. And the saddest case, I suppose, is a certain city in southwest England, where the revolutionary approach to fares that was adopted, nearly 7-8 years ago now, was an incredibly brave decision, but it kicked off a transformation of the bus product in Bristol that has led to a 50% increase in demand. Now, I know everybody mutters about, but we don't get any money, we don't make any money out of it. I don't know if that's necessarily true. They might not make as much as they used to, but it did change the public perception of the product. And I think that's an important lesson, as well as the PR and other marketing advantages that came from actually consulting. I think that was an example that we should follow more.
Make sure you get your copy of Understanding Buses by Chris Cheek. Available on Amazon and from the publishers.
My book, Understanding Buses, I wrote 2 years ago and updated earlier this year, precisely because I was concerned that all sorts of decisions were being made by people who didn't understand the industry. And I wanted to create something that was simple, easy to read, jargon-free, but got the point across. Now, lots of people in the industry tell me that that's what I achieved, which I'm very pleased about, but it's still there, and it could be useful in getting our message across to stakeholders, to politicians, and to our own new staff. So that's there on Amazon and on the website.
Brilliant. Which, give us the website address, Chris, so we can...
The website is pastrans.co.uk.
So there we have it. Not only has Chris given us half an hour of his time on our podcast, but you can read lots more valuable information in his book, available, as you heard, on Amazon or at the website. And whether you're a seasoned industry person, whether you're a politician, a local authority officer, or somebody new in the industry, there's plenty to learn in Chris's book, and I really hope you get it. So my guest today on Lunch with Leon has been Chris Cheek. Chris and I have known each other for more years than we dare admit, but we're still here causing trouble and commentating on what's going on in this fabulous industry. And it's been fascinating to catch up and learn your views on this really interesting period that we've got now, this post-COVID uncertainty in an industry that we care about very much. So this has been Lunch with Leon, which is produced and published by itthub.net. Please go across to our website, where you find details of this and our other podcasts, as well as our news channel. In the meantime, once again, thanks very much indeed, Chris Cheek.
Lunch with Leon is brought to you by ITT Hub. Check out all the latest industry news at itthub.net. And don't forget to put in your diary our next great live industry show at Farnborough International on the 11th and 12th of May 2022.